This is Tom Roy with radio news from Waveform's WGXC in New York. News about radio waves, transmission art, wireless surveillance, and other broadcast issues from wavefarm.org. Edward Wyatt and Nick Bilton at the New York Times report about the FCC's plan to hold a vote on allowing airlines to allow folks to talk on cell phones during flights. While the vote is on the December 12th agenda, the decision is months away. It still requires a public comment period and a final draft of the rules. Some airlines in Asia and Europe already offer cell phone service on flights, though flight attendants and flight attendant unions have been vehemently opposed in the United States. Tom Wheeler, the FCC chairman, released a statement November 20th announcing the vote, saying that it would, quote, expand consumer access and choice for in-flight mobile broadband, unquote. He said, quote, modern technologies can deliver mobile services in the air safely and reliably, and the time is right to review our outdated and restrictive rules, unquote. I look forward to working closely with my colleagues, the FAA, and the airline industry on this review of new mobile opportunities for consumers, unquote. The American Association of Flight Attendants, a union, quickly came out with a statement saying that flight attendants, as first responders in the last line of defense in our nation's aviation system, understand the importance of maintaining a calm cabin environment, unquote. Quote, any situation that is loud and divisive and possibly disruptive is not only unwelcome, but also unsafe. Wheeler has since come out against the measure and says if the FCC passes the proposal, it would still be up to the airline whether they want to implement cell phone calls on airlines. American Airlines, for its part, says its current Wi-Fi doesn't, quote, doesn't allow voice calls, unquote, and the aircraft would need to be outfitted with new small satellite cell station technology, which would need to be approved by the Federal Aviation Administration. So don't expect to make a phone call anytime soon, but maybe next year. Paul Rimsmondale at Radiosurvivor.com digs deeper into the 2,799 low-power FM applications that are before the Federal Communications Commission. The FCC originally said there were 2,819 applications, but that number has dropped by 20 as a couple of duplicates have been wormed out of the results. You can go to fcc.gov to see a complete database with all the information from every application. Skywaves, a broadcast engineering firm, also has a downloadable PDF listing all the applications by city and state at its website. And the reaction has been mostly positive, but some activist groups thought there would be more applications. Common Frequency President Clay Leander said his group is aware of, quote, yet more qualified nonprofits who were in need of assistance with second adjacent exhibits and other engineering tasks who didn't get to follow through with filings, unquote. He explained that there was, quote, an engineering crunch, unquote, as some groups waited for final rulings that the FCC only gave out on October 17th as the FCC low-power FM window opened late because of the government shutdown. And during the time of the government shutdown, no FCC officials were available for questions or to help applicants with their filings. Leander says that, quote, we are most appreciative to the Congress and the FCC for enacting and implementing the Local Community Radio Act, unquote. But, quote, procedurally, some things were not properly sequenced, unquote. According to REC Networks, they have flagged several applications that they deem will be ruled eventually invalid. By their count, there are 2,399 applications after ruling out the duplicates and invalid applications they've noticed. Already, the FCC has dismissed 7 applications, mainly for being duplicates. The commission also has marked 700 applications as, quote, accepted for filing, unquote, which means that someone at the commission gave the application a once-over before the thorough vetting process begins. Radio Survivor is also reporting that more than 100 of the applicants are from colleges, and that there are 15 applications alone in San Francisco. REC Networks is claiming that multiple applications are coming from the same sources, and in a statement posted last week, they say REC is currently investigating many applications that may be part of larger organizations who are attempting to undermine the localism of the LPFM service, unquote. Organizations that currently run full power stations were not allowed to apply for low power FM stations in this application window. The FCC's next step is to deal with the 1,488 singleton applications, those with no competing applications for the frequency in their geographic areas. The FCC should be able to give out construction permits for these stations by the beginning of 2014, according to Radio Survivor. After that, the commission deals with the mutually exclusive applications, those that have competing applications in the same geographic area. The FCC encourages groups in those conditions to talk to each other and try to work out a deal before they come in with their number system and enforce a deal. Gothamist.com has a long interview with composer Steve Reich, mostly about his Radio Rewrite piece, the classical composition he recently debuted at the Guggenheim that reworks Radiohead. Now he's got a 20-member band called Alarm Will Sound performing Radio Rewrite at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Here's an excerpt of that performance.
Thank you.
Paul Rimsmondale at RadioSurvivor.com also has a roundup of recent pirate radio enforcement at the FCC on the FM, shortwave, and citizen bands. He says there's been lots of activity on both coasts, mostly in California and New York, where several pirates have been shut down on shortwave and FM frequencies. Rimsmondale also tracks the history of the infamous November 22nd, 1987 pirate television broadcast that has become known as the Max Headroom broadcast, as a Max Headroom masked man briefly interrupted a Chicago newscast on WGN and WTTW. This was in the mid-80s, around the time when there were several pirate television takeovers of satellite feeds from Home Box Office and others. And while many of those pirates were caught, the identity of the Chicago Max Headroom pirate television perpetrator has never been found. Chris Niddle in Vice Magazine's Motherboard does some digging in a recent story, claiming to find a man who says he met who was a teenager at the time and claims he met the broadcasters. He also talks to the former bureau chief of the FCC's Operations Bureau, who says the agent in charge of the investigation didn't do a very good job.
That is stupid. You should talk often with the old ones of your tribe. That is the only way to learn.
I'll get you a hot drink, miss.
I've done some dry clothes.
As far as I can tell, a massive electric shock, he died instantly.
The generator? Are you always so careful?
Go to radiosurvivor.com to links to the Vice story and for more about pirate radio enforcement in the United States. We reported a few weeks ago that Tom Sharpling, the comedian that runs the best show on WFMU in the Tuesday 9 p.m. Eastern time slot, was leaving in December. He's being replaced by comedian Dave Hill, who currently hosts his own podcast called Dave Hill Podcasting Incident and has been a guest on Public Radio's Wits and This American Life. Free Speech Radio News sent out another missive Thanksgiving weekend saying that it is trying to get back on the air in 2014. Quote, "We have been busy these past weeks exploring options to best transition Free Speech Radio News to get back to work distributing the independent grassroots news you seek," unquote. They say they have been seeking funding as they went off the air September 27, 2013, owed almost $200,000 from the Pacifica Radio Foundation, and in a constant state of begging for money. Free Speech Radio News also wanted to update listeners about one correspondent, Madonna Virola from the Philippines, is all right after the typhoon hit there recently. Go to fsrn.org for more information about Free Speech Radio News. About.com is reporting that Mike Huckabee, the former presidential candidate, has ended his radio show. The Mike Huckabee Show went on the air on April of 2012, and the last program airs December 12, 2013. While it was on the radio, it was mostly in the 12 to 3 p.m. slot opposite Rush Limbaugh, who obviously had much higher ratings than Mike Huckabee. Huckabee is a former Arkansas governor, presidential candidate, and current Fox News television host. He's also continuing his three short daily commentaries, The Huckabee Report, syndicated on hundreds of stations in the United States. This week in radio history. On December 3rd, 1923, the first congressional open session was broadcast on the radio. A few days later, on December 6th, the first presidential radio broadcast, as U.S. President Calvin Coolidge spoke on the radio on December 6, 1923. On December 3rd, 1950, Paul Harvey began his AM radio national talk show.
Hello, Americans. This is Paul Harvey. Stand by for news.
On December 4th, 1954, Billboard magazine reported that New York Supreme Court Justice Carol J. Walker denied disc jockey Alan Freed any further use of the nickname Moondog on his radio show.
Hello, everybody. Hi, all tonight. This is Alan Freed, the old king of the Moondoggers, and it's time again for another of your favorite rock and roll sessions, blues and rhythm records for all the gang in the Moondog Kingdom from the Midwest to the East Coast. We're going to be saying hello to a lot of folks who've written to us tonight from all over the Moondog Kingdom, all around the Cleveland area, Newark, New Jersey, New York City, Long Island, wherever you are. And I hope you folks have a good supply of good old Aaron Brew on hand. It's the greatest beer of them all, Northern Ohio's largest selling beer, and it's perfectly balanced for good taste and flavor. So enjoy Aaron Brew as you enjoy the Moondog Show.
Of course, the first few days of December are known in radio history after the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, as he often did, took to the radio airwaves.
And now, back to the capital of the United States.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States has asked the Congress to declare a state of war, that a state of war exists between the United States and Japan. He has retired from the chamber of the House of Representatives, from which point he has spoken to the joint session of the Congress. The Speaker has declared the joint session dissolved. The members of the President's Cabinet have retired. They were followed immediately by the members of the Supreme Court. And now the Senate. They're leaving the House chamber. The applause you hear in the background comes from the members of the House who cheer their colleagues from the other side of the Capitol building. 96 senators, presumably most of them here because, well, it would appear that they are slowly filing out the center aisle, the north door of the House chamber, down the long corridor to the Senate chamber. The Speaker of the House conferring for a moment with his parliamentarian, Louis Dreisler. And we'll stay with the action here on the House floor for a few moments in order that we may bring you the introduction of the resolution by the Honorable John W. McCormick of Massachusetts, the Majority Leader of the House of Representatives, whom we've been told will present the resolution for the House of Representatives, recognizing the state of war does exist between the United States and the Empire of Japan.
Yesterday, December 7, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. It will be recorded that the distance of Hawaii from Japan makes it obvious that the attack was deliberately planned many days or even weeks ago. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
Finally, from poet and radio artist Gregory Whitehead, In the End.
In the end, the same as the beginning. In the beginning, the same as the end. In the end, the same as the beginning. In the beginning, the same as the end. In the end, the same as the beginning. In the beginning, the same as the end. In the end, the same as the beginning. In the beginning, the same as the end. In the end, the same as the beginning. In the beginning, the same as the end. In the end, the same as the beginning. In the beginning, the same as the end. In the end, the same as the beginning. In the beginning, the same as the end. In the end, the same as the beginning. In the beginning, the same as the end.
And the beginning is the same
as the
end is the same. The end is the same.
The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.